Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome.
Welcome to the Bard's Grove. Hi, Lantern.
How are you tonight, Kat?
I'm fine. How's everything over on the East Coast?
Oh, real good, real good. We have a little tiny bit of a cool spell here. It's been nice waking up to a nice high 40s. Put a little brisk lift in your footstep.
Yep. Same here out west. Everybody's going, it's cold, but it's only in the 30s, so it's not like it's really cold or 40s. It's brisk, as you say.
You're still see that smoky stuff from the Reno fires, are you?
No, we're not. We haven't gotten any yet, although the sunsets have been quite magnificent from the dust. but I don't know if it's from the Reno fires. I don't know if the winds are coming from the north. We'll have to see.
Yeah. So there's a lot up in the sky, you tell us, huh?
Yes, the cosmic story is really snapping this week.
Well,
especially
tell us about
this weekend. Well, today the sun went into Aquarius, so we get this different perspective. We've just come through the month of Capricorn, which really is about how we align with our cultural structures, if you will, the social structures that bind us together. And a couple of weeks ago at the Cancer full moon, we really got a chance to look at it and say, how do our social structures take care of our needs? And pretty much the answer is not very well. So with the new moon in Aquarius, we try to answer the question that came up for us at that moment of the full moon. And so we say, well, if our social structures aren't taking care of our needs, what's the new vision? And Aquarius is all about the vision. It's a fixed air sign. It's about our ideals. It's about the archetypal patterns. And it's about us knowing that we're all in this together, the group mind. So we're really, you know, this is the beginning, Monday, the Sunday night, Monday morning, the new moon in Aquarius. Then we have Chinese New Year, which is the year of the dragon, the water dragon. And so it's a year of change and unpredictability. It's a 5-year in numerology, a lot of change, a lot of wanting the need for freedom and for that bigger vision that takes the common good into consideration. So it's beautiful. The story right now is quite beautiful. And so basically we need a new story. And the old story, as it falls apart, if we don't put a new story in its place, there'll be a vacuum and the old story will continue to work on us. That old story of fear and scarcity and control.
And now you also mentioned something about Mars, too.
Yes, Mars, our beloved Mars, our erotic, desirous, passionate energy. That wants to grapple with things. As a matter of fact, the god Mars, originally the Roman god, was a god, I don't know quite of agriculture, he might have been, but he was the one who would defend the city. He would grapple with things. And so it's this energy of really working things out. And in Virgo, it's turning around. So if everything feels like it's taking a pause, people, that might be why. And so Mars is about to turn into retrograde, a backward motion. It happens once every 2 years. And in Virgo, it's going to give us the chance to really work on the details of our health regime, the details of whatever the plans are that we're focusing on for this year, the details of who we are and how do we integrate our body, mind, and spirit. How do we listen to our heart, use our brains to get us what our heart wants, have the physical stamina to do it, and the spiritual wisdom to understand what's going on. So even though people usually go, Mars retrograde, nothing gets done, you know, it really depends on how you make use of the energy. Mars going in within, retrograde means the energy turns within and looks at the inner world. If you're sending this passion down to your soul, you're going to find your truth, and then you're going to know what you need to do. So hopefully for the next 2 months, people will be turning within, listening to themselves, getting an idea of what their part of the bigger story is, and then coming out with it and showing us this summer what can be done.
Well,
we have a lot of passion. We have a lot of people and a lot of passion. Let's focus it.
And sounds good, Kat.
I love what the planets and the stars tell us. And of course, there's so much more going on. You can find it on the internet all over the place, on Facebook, lots of astrologers. But if people are interested and they aren't already on my mailing list, they are welcome to go to my website. It's called wisdom-of-astrology.com and just scroll down to the Aquarius New Moon link, and it will take you to the newsletter.
Yes, you want to get on that newsletter. It is awesome. She brings out so much interesting information. You need to talk to the cat. Thank you, Kat.
Okay. So if you don't mind letting ladies go first, I would love to tell a little Aquarian story.
Why, sure. After all, for some people, this is a PFW, right?
Yep. So, you know, some astrologers would argue that Aquarius shouldn't be ruled by the god Uranus or Uranus, the starry heavens, but by the Titan Prometheus, because Aquarians are very like Prometheus. So I'm going to tell you the story of Prometheus. This is a version by James Baldwin, and it's called How Fire Was Given to Men. In those old, old times, there lived two brothers who were not like other men, nor yet like those mighty ones who lived upon the mountaintop. They were the sons of one of those titans who had fought against Jupiter and been sent in chains to the strong prison house of the lower world. The name of these brothers, the elder of these brothers, was Prometheus, or Forethought. For he was always thinking of the future and making things ready for what might happen tomorrow or next week or next year or even 100 years in the future. The younger was named Epimetheus, or Afterthought, for he was always so busy thinking of yesterday or last year or 100 years ago that he had no care at all for what might come to pass after a while. Well, for some cause, Jupiter had not sent these brothers to prison with the rest of the Titans. Prometheus did not care to live amidst the clouds on the mountaintop. He was too busy for that, while the mighty folk were spending their time in idleness, drinking nectar and eating ambrosia. He was intent upon plans for making the world wiser and better than it had ever been before. He went out amongst men to live with them and help them. For his heart was filled with sadness when he found that they were no longer happy as they had been during the golden age when Saturn was king. Ah, how very poor and wretched they were. He found them living in caves and in holes in the earth, shivering with the cold because there was no fire, dying of starvation, hunted by wild beasts and by one another, the most miserable of all living creatures. If they only had fire, thought Prometheus, they could at least warm themselves and cook their food. And after a while, they could learn to make tools and build themselves houses. Without fire, they are worse off than the beasts. Then he went boldly to Jupiter and begged him to give fire to men so that they might have a little comfort through the long, dreary months of winter. Not a spark will I give, said Jupiter. No, indeed. Why, if men had fire, they might become strong and wise like ourselves. And after a while, they would drive us out of our kingdom. Let them shiver with cold and let them live like the beasts. It's best for them to be poor and ignorant so that we mighty ones may thrive and be happy. Prometheus made no answer, but he had set his heart on helping mankind, and he did not give up. He turned away and left Jupiter and his mighty company forever. As he was walking by the shore of the sea, he found a reed, or as some say, a tall stalk of fennel growing. And when he had broken it off, he saw that its hollow center was filled with a dry, soft pith that would burn slowly and keep on fire a long time. He took the long stalk in his hand and started with it towards the dwelling of the sun in the far east. Mankind shall have fire in spite of that tyrant who sits on the mountaintop, Prometheus swore. Well, he reached the place of the sun early in the morning, just as the glowing golden orb was rising from the earth and beginning his daily journey through the sky. He touched the end of the long reed to the flames, and the dry pith caught on fire and burned slowly. Then he turned and hastened back to his own land, carrying with him the precious spark hidden in the hollow center of the plant. He called some of the shivering people from their caves and built a fire for them and showed them how to warm themselves by it and how to build other fires from the coals. Soon there was a cheerful blaze in every rude home in the land, and men and women gathered round it and were warm and happy and thankful to Prometheus for the wonderful gift which he had brought them from the sun. It was not long until they learned to cook their food and so to eat like men instead of like beasts. They began at once to leave off their wild and savage habits, and instead of lurking in the dark places of the world, they came out into the open air and the bright sunlight and were glad because life had been given to them. After that, Prometheus taught them little by little a thousand things. He showed them how to build houses of wood and stone, and how to tame sheep and cattle and make them useful, and how to plow and sow and reap, and how to protect themselves from the storms of winter and the beasts of the woods. And then he showed them how to dig in the earth for copper and iron, and how to melt the ore, and how to hammer it into shape, and fashion from it the tools and weapons which they needed in peace and in war. And when he saw how happy the world was becoming, he cried out, "A new golden age shall come, brighter and better by far than the old." How diseases and cares came upon men. Chapter 2. Things might have gone on very happily indeed, and the golden age might really have come, had it not been for Jupiter. But one day, when he checked to look down upon the earth, he saw the fires burning, and the people living in houses, and the flocks feeding on the hills, and the grain ripening in the fields. And this made him very angry. "Who has done all this?" he asked. And someone answered, "Prometheus." "Ah, that young Titan. Well, I will punish him in a way that will make him wish I had shut him up in the prison house with his kinsfolk. But as for those puny men, let them keep their fire. I will make them 10 times more miserable than they were before they had it." And of course, it would have been easy to deal with Prometheus at any time. And so Jupiter was in no great haste to do it. He made up his mind to distress mankind first, and he thought of a plan for doing it in a very strange, roundabout way. In the first place, he ordered his blacksmith Vulcan, whose forge was in the crater of a burning mountain, to take a lump of clay that he gave him and mold it into the form of a woman. Vulcan did as he was bidden, and when he had finished the image, he carried it to Jupiter, who was sitting among the clouds with all the mighty folk around him. It was nothing but a mere lifeless body, but the great blacksmith had given it a form more perfect than that of any statue that had ever been made. "Come now," said Jupiter, "let us all give some godly gift to this woman." And he began by giving her life. And then the others came in their turn, each with a gift for the marvelous creature. One gave her beauty, another a pleasant voice, and still another good manners, and another a kind heart, and still another skill in many arts. And lastly, someone gave her curiosity. Then they called her Pandora, which means the all-gifted, because she had received gifts from all of them. Pandora was so beautiful and so wondrously gifted that no one could help loving her. When the mighty folk had admired her for a time, they gave her to Mercury, the light-footed messenger, and he led her down the mountainside to the place where Prometheus and his brother were living and toiling for the good of mankind. He met Epimetheus first and said to him, "Epimetheus, here is a beautiful woman whom Jupiter has sent to you to be your wife." Now, Prometheus had often warned his brother to beware of any gift that Jupiter might send, for he knew that the mighty tyrant could not be trusted. But when Epimetheus saw Pandora, how lovely and wise she was, he forgot all the warnings and took her home to live with him and be his wife. Pandora was very happy in her new home, and even Prometheus, when he saw her, was pleased with her loveliness. She had brought with her a golden casket, though, which Jupiter had given her at parting, and which he had told her held many precious things. But wise Athena, the queen of the air, had warned her to never, never open it, nor look at the things inside. Well, one day, Pandora thought, as she looked at the golden casket, they must be jewels. And then she thought how they would add to her beauty if only she could wear them. Why did Jupiter give them to me if I should never use them, nor so much as look at them, she wondered. The more she thought about the golden casket, the more curious she was to see what was in it. And every day she took it down from its shelf and felt the lid and tried to peer inside it without opening it. Finally, she thought, why should I care for what Athena told me? She's not beautiful, and jewels would be of no use to her. She doesn't even like jewels. I think that I'll look at them at any rate. Athena will never know. Nobody else will know. And so she opened the lid a very little, just to peep inside. One second. Okay. All at once, there was a whirring, rustling sound, and before she could shut it down, out flew 10,000 strange creatures with death-like faces and gaunt and dreadful forms such as no one in all the world had ever seen before. They fluttered for a little while about the room and then flew away to find dwelling places where there were homes of men. Now, they were the diseases and cares, for up until that time, mankind had not had any kind of sickness, nor felt any trouble of mind, nor worried about what the tomorrow might bring. These creatures flew into every house, and without anyone seeing them, nestled down in the bosoms of men and women and children, and put an end to all their joy. And ever since that day, they have been flitting and creeping, unseen and unheard, over all the land, bringing pain and sorrow and death into every household. If Pandora had not shut down the lid so quickly, things would have gone much worse. But she closed it just in time to keep the last of the evil creatures from getting out. Now, the name of this creature was Foreboding. And although he was almost half out of the casket, Pandora pushed him back in and shut the lid so tight that he could never escape. For you see, if he had gone out into the world, men would have known from childhood just what troubles were coming to them every day of their lives, and they would never have had any hope or joy so long as they lived. And so this was the way in which Jupiter sought to make mankind more miserable than they had been before Prometheus befriended them. Chapter 3, How the Friend of Men Was Punished. The next thing that Jupiter did was to punish Prometheus for stealing fire from the sun. He bade two of his servants, whose names were Strength and Force, to seize the bold Titan and carry him to the topmost peak of the Caucasus Mountains. And then he sent the blacksmith Vulcan to bind him with iron chains and fetter him to the rocks so that he could not move hand nor foot. Vulcan didn't want to do this, for he was a friend of Prometheus, and yet he dared not disobey. And so the great friend of men, who had given them fire and lifted them out of their wretchedness and shown them how to live, was chained to the mountain peak. And there he hung, with the storm winds whistling always around him, and the pitiless hail beating in his face, and fierce eagles shrieking in his ears and tearing his body with their cruel claws. Yet he bore all his sufferings without a groan, and never would he beg for mercy or say that he was sorry for what he had done. Year after year, and age after age, Prometheus hung there. Now and then old Helios, the driver of the sun car, would look down upon him and smile. Now and then flocks of birds would bring him messages from far-off lands. And once the ocean nymphs came and sang wonderful songs for him. And oftentimes men looked up to him with pitying eyes, and they cried out against the tyrant who had placed him there. Then, once upon a time, a white cow passed that way, a strangely beautiful cow with large, sad eyes and a face that seemed almost human. She stopped and looked up at the cold gray peak and the giant body that was chained there. Prometheus saw her and spoke to her kindly. "I know who you are," he said. "You're Io, who was once a fair and happy maiden in distant Argos. And now, because of the tyrant Jupiter and his jealous queen, you are doomed to wander from land to land in human form. But don't lose hope. Go on to the south and then to the west. After many days, you'll come to the great river Nile. There, once again, you'll become a maiden, but fairer and more beautiful than before. And you'll become the wife of the king of that land and will give birth to a son, from whom will spring the hero who will eventually break my chains and set me free. As for me, I can bide in patience for the day, which not even Jupiter can hasten or delay. Fare thee well." Poor Io would have spoken, but she couldn't. Her sorrowful eyes looked once more at the suffering hero on the peak, and then she turned and began her long and tiresome journey to the land of the Nile. Well, ages passed, and at last a great hero, whose name was Hercules, came to the land of the Caucasus. In spite of Jupiter's dreaded thunderbolts and fearful storms of snow and sleet, he climbed the rugged mountain peak. He slew the fierce eagles that had so long tormented the helpless prisoner on those craggy heights. And with a mighty blow, he broke the fetters of Prometheus and set the grand old hero free. "I knew that you would come," said Prometheus. 10 generations ago, I spoke of you to Io, who was afterwards the queen of the land of the Nile. And Io," said Hercules, "was the mother of the race from which I am sprung."
Very good.
Well, that is the end of the story of Prometheus. And you can see a lot of the Aquarian virtues he has. He is concerned about the fate of humankind. He's willing to be the rebel and go up against the powers that be. He's willing to take on and suffer, if you will, to give people what they need. And that's the kind of heroes we seem to need today.
Well, I've got some heroes from yesteryear myself.
Okay.
I've got a group of 7 brothers, the 7 Simians. There lived an old man and his old wife. They lived many, many years ago in a great age. They began to pray to God one day to give them a child who in their old age might help them to work. They prayed a year. They prayed a second. They prayed a third and a fourth. They prayed a fifth and a sixth and did not receive a child. But in the 7th year, the Lord gave them 7 sons, and they called them all Simeon. When the old man with the old woman died, the Simeons were left orphans in their 10th year. They plowed their own land and were not worse than their neighbors. It happened one time to Tsar Ador, the ruler of all that country, to pass their village, and he saw the 7 Simeons working in the field. He wondered greatly that such small boys were plowing and harrowing. Therefore, he sent his chief boyar to inquire whose children they were. When the boyar came to the Simeons, he asked why they, such small boys, were doing such heavy work. Well, the eldest Simeon answered that they were orphans and that there was no one to work for them, and said at the same time they were all called Simeon. The boyar left and told this to the Tsar, who wondered greatly that so many small boys, brothers, should be called by one name. Therefore, he sent the same boyar to take them to the palace. The boyar carried out the command of the Tsar and took all the Simeons with him. When the Tsar came to the palace, he assembled the boyars and men of council and asked advice in the following words.
My boyars and men of council, ye see these seven orphans who have no relatives. I wish to make of them men who may be grateful to me hereafter. Therefore I ask counsel of you, in what science or art should I have them instructed?
To this, all answered as follows. Most gracious sovereign, as they are now grown somewhat and have reason, dost thou not think it well to ask each one of them separately with what science or art he would like to occupy himself? The Tsar accepted this advice gladly and began by asking the eldest Simeon, listen to me, my friend. With whatever science or art thou wishest to occupy thyself, in that I will have thee instructed. Simeon answered, Your Majesty, I have no wish to occupy myself with any science or art. But if you would give command to build a forge in the middle of your courtyard, I would forge a pillar reaching to the sky. The Tsar saw that there was no reason to teach this Simeon, for he knew well enough that the art of a blacksmith. Still, he did not believe that the boy could forge a pillar to the very sky. Therefore, he gave a command to build in quick time a forge in the middle of his courtyard. After the first, he called the second Simeon. And thou, my friend, whatever science or art thou wish to study, in that I will give thee to be taught. Then that Simeon answered, Your Majesty, I do not wish to study any science or art, but if my eldest brother will forge a pillar to the sky, then I will climb that pillar to the top, and will look at all the lands and tell you what is going on in each of them. The Tsar considered that there was no need to teach this Simeon either, because he was already wise enough. Then he asked the third Simeon, Now, my friend, what science or art dost thou wish to be learning? Simeon answered, Your Majesty, I do not wish to learn any science or art, but if my eldest brother will make me an axe, with the axe I will strike once, twice, and that moment there will be a ship. The king answered, I need shipwrights, and thou shouldst not be taught anything else. Next he asked the fourth, Thou, Simeon, what science or art dost thou wish to know? Your Majesty, answered he, I do not wish to know any science, but if my third brother should make a ship, and if it should happen to that ship to be at sea and an enemy should attack it, I would seize it by the prow and take the ship to the underground kingdom. And when the enemy had gone away, I would bring it back to the surface of the sea. The Tsar was astonished at these great wonders of the four Simeon, and he said, There is no need to teach thee either. Then he asked the fifth Simeon, And thou, Simeon, what science or art dost thou wish to learn?
I do not wish to learn any, said he, but if my eldest brother will make me a gun, with that gun, if I see a bird, I will hit it, even 100 versts distant.
Well, thou wilt be a splendid sharpshooter for me, said the Tsar. Then he asked the sixth Simeon, Thou, Simeon, what science dost thou wish to begin?
Your Majesty, began Simeon,
I have no wish to begin any science or art, but if my fifth brother will shoot a bird on the wing, I will not let it reach the earth, but I will catch it and bring it to you.
Thou art very cunning, said the Tsar. Thou wilt take the place of a retriever for me in the field.
Then the Tsar asked the last Simeon, What art or science dost thou wish to learn?
Your Majesty, answered he,
I do not wish to learn any science or art because I have a most precious craft.
But what is thy craft? Tell me if it please thee.
I know how to steal dexterously, said Simeon, so that no man can steal in comparison with me.
The Tsar became greatly enraged, hearing of such an evil art, and said to his boyars and men of council, "Gentlemen, how do ye advise me to punish this thief Simeon? Tell me what death he should die." "Your Majesty," said they all to him, "why put him to death? He is a thief in name, but a thief who may be needed on an occasion." "For what reason?" asked the Tsar. "For this reason, Your Majesty, is trying now these 10 years to get Tsarevna Yelena the Beautiful, and you have not been able to get her. And besides, you've lost great forces and armies and spent much treasure in other things. Mayhap the Simeon the thief may yet in some way be able to steal Yelena the Beautiful for Your Majesty." The Tsar said in answer, "My friends, ye tell me the truth." Then he turned to Simeon the thief and asked, "Well, Simeon, canst thou go to the 30th land, to the 30th kingdom, and steal for me Yelena the Beautiful? I am strongly in love with her, and if thou canst steal her, I will give thee a great reward." "Stealing is my art, Your Majesty," answered the seventh Simeon, "and I will steal her for you, only give the command." "Not only do I give the command, but I beg thee to do it and delay no longer at my court, but take for thyself troops and money, whatever is needed." "Neither troops nor treasure do I need," he answered. "Let all of us brothers go together, and I will get Tsarevna Yelena the Beautiful." The Tsar did not like to part with all the Simeons, though still he regretted it. He was obliged to let them all go together. Meanwhile, the forge was built in the court. The eldest Simeon forged an iron pillar to the very sky. The second Simeon climbed on that pillar to the top and looked in the direction in which was the kingdom of the father of Yelena the Beautiful. And after he had looked, he cried from the top of the pillar, "Your Majesty, I see Yelena the Beautiful sitting beyond the thrice ninth land in the 30th kingdom under a window. Her marrow flows from bone to bone." Now, the Tsar was still more enticed by her beauty, and he said to the Simeons in a loud voice, "My friends, start your journey at once. I cannot leave without Yelena, the beautiful Tsarevna." The eldest Simeon made for an axe for the third, and for the fifth he made a gun, and after that they took bread for the journey, and Simeon the thief took a cat. And they went their way. Simeon the thief had made the cat so used to him that she ran after him everywhere like a dog. And if he stopped on the road or in any other place, the cat stood on her hind legs, rubbed against him, and purred. So the brothers went their way for some time, and at last came to the sea, which they had to cross, and there was nothing to cross upon. They walked along the shore and looked for a tree of some kind to make a vessel, and they found a very large oak. The third Simeon took his axe and cut the oak at the very root, and with one stroke and another, he made straight away a ship, which was rigged, and all in the ship were various costly goods. All the Simeons sat on that ship and sailed on their journey. A few months, they arrived safely at the place where it was necessary for them to go. When they entered the harbor, they cast anchor at once. On the following day, Simeon the thief took his cat and went into town. Coming to the Tsar's palace, he stood opposite the window of Yelena the Beautiful. At that moment, the cat stood on her hind legs and began to rub against him and to purr. It's necessary to say that the kingdom, they knew nothing of cats, and they had not heard of what kind of beast the cat was. Tsarevna, Yelena the Beautiful, was sitting at the window, and seeing the cat, sent straightaway her nurses and maidens to ask Simeon what kind of beast that was. Would he not sell it, and what price would he take? The maidens and nurses ran out in the street and asked Simeon what kind of beast that was, and would he not sell it? Simeon answered, "My ladies, be pleased to relate to Her Highness Yelena the Beautiful that this little beast is called a cat, that I will not sell it, but if she wishes to have it, I will give it to her without price." The maidens and nurses ran straight to the palace and told what they had heard from Simeon. Tsarevna, Yelena the Beautiful, was rejoiced beyond measure. She ran out herself and asked Simeon would he not sell the cat. Simeon said, "Your Highness, I will not sell the cat, but if you like her, I will make you a present of her. Tsarevna took the cat in her arms and went into the palace, and Simeon she commanded to follow. When she came to the palace, the Tsarevna went to her father and showed him the cat, and explaining that a certain foreigner had given it to her as a present. The Tsar, seeing such a wonderful little beast, was greatly delighted and gave orders to call Simeon the thief, and when he came, the Tsar wished to reward him with money for the cat. But as Simeon would not take it, he said, "My friend, live for this time in my house, and meanwhile, in your presence, the cat will become better used to my daughter." To this, Simeon did not agree and said to the Tsar, "Your Majesty, I could live with great delight in your house if I had not the ship on which I came to your kingdom, and which I cannot commit to anyone. But if you command me, I will come every day and teach the cat to know your daughter." The Tsar commanded Simeon to come every day. Simeon began to visit Tsarevna Yelena the Beautiful. And one day he said to her, "Gracious lady, often have I come here. I see that you are not pleased to walk anywhere, that you might come to my ship, and I would show you such costly brocades as you have never seen till this day." Then Tsarevna went straight away to her father and began to beg permission to go to the ship wharf. The Tsar permitted her and told her to take nurses and maids and go with Simeon. As soon as they came to the wharf, Simeon invited her to his ship. And when she entered the ship, Simeon and his brothers began to show the Tsarevna various rich brocades. Then Simeon the thief said to Yelena the Beautiful, "Now be pleased to tell your nurses and maids to leave the ship, because I wish to show you things so costly that they should not even see them." The Tsarevna commanded her maidens and nurses to leave the ship, and as soon as they had gone, Simeon the thief ordered his brothers in silence to cut off the anchor and go to sea with all sail. Meanwhile, he showed the Tsarevna rich goods and made her presents of some. About 2 hours had passed when he was showing the stuff, and at last she said it was time for her to go home. The Tsar, her father, would expect her to dinner. And then she went out of the cabin and saw that the ship was under sail and the land no longer even in sight. She struck herself on the breast, turning into a swan, and flew off. The fifth Simeon took his gun that minute and wounded the swan. The sixth Simeon did not let her fall to the water, but brought her back to the ship, where she became a maiden as before. The nurses and maidens who were at the wharf, seeing the ship move away from the shore with the Tsarevna, ran straight to the Tsar and told him of Simeon's deceit. Then the Tsar sent a whole fleet in pursuit, and when this fleet came coming up, was very near the ship of the Simeons, the fourth Simeons seized the prow and conducted the ship to the underground kingdom. When the ship had become entirely invisible, the commanders of the fleet thought it was lost with the Tsarevna. Therefore they returned and reported to the Tsar that Simeon's ship had gone to the bottom with Yelena the Beautiful. The Simeons arrived at their own kingdom successfully, delivered Yelena the Beautiful to the Tsar Ador, who for such a mighty service of the Simeons gave liberty to them all, plenty of gold, silver, and precious stones, married Yelena the Beautiful himself, and lived with her many years. And so ends the story of the seven Simeons.
Very good. the tricksters always are good, aren't they?
Oh, I'll tell you, I've never seen seven brothers put to better use.
Yeah, yeah. So, would you like me to talk a little bit with some stories, or do you have another one you'd like to tell?
No, go ahead, my dear cat.
Well, you know, it's the year of the dragon, and it's a water dragon. And therefore, they call it the black dragon or the black water dragon. And I really don't know Chinese stories about dragons. They represented the power of heaven and creativity, and of course, were a symbol of the emperor. But and they were always positive, whereas here in the West we see dragons as sometimes negative, sometimes positive. I hear that there's plans for making Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern into a movie. It should be wonderful. These are the best dragons going. But, you know, we have modern-day fantasies about dragons and being wise and conscious, and we have modern-day fantasies about dragons being unconscious and vicious. But I'd like to read you a few stories about the different types of dragons. There are four types of dragons, one for each element. And so I'm going to read you a little story if we have time from each.
Go ahead.
Okay? So there's this is from the tradition, the Celtic tradition of the water dragon, and this is a little song. One Sunday morning, Lambton went a-fishing in the weir and caught a fish upon his hook he thought looked very queer. But what in a kind of fish it was, young Lambton couldn't tell. He couldn't fash to carry it home, so he honed it in a well. And this is an old myth, and sometimes these water, the water dragons will come to earth because water can flow with so many energies, and so it can flow with earth. Uh-huh. And so this Lambton worm in County Durham was immortalized in this folk song. And it was first discovered by Lambton when he was a boy, when he was fishing in the River Weir. Contemptuous of his little catch, which turned out to be a strange eel-like creature, he threw it in a well, forgetting all about it, until years later he returned from the Crusades to discover that the worm had grew and grew so lithely and so strong that he no longer lived in the well, but at night crawled about to pick up bits of news, and if he felt dry upon the road, he milked a dozen cows. After he feasted on calves and lambs and children and sheep, he would crawl away and lap his tail 10 times around Lambton Hill. Well, this Lambton had a special suit of armor made with the front and back studded with steel blades, and then he stood on a rock in the middle of the river and blew a horn, waking the worm, which had been coiled to sleep on the hill nearby. And slithering down to the river, it wound itself around Lambton, trying to crush him, but the blades tore and cut at the worm, who fell in pieces into the river. And that's a little story about the water dragon, the Lambton worm. So then we have the earth dragon. So, of course, the earth dragon, we have the dragon lines that we talk about, the ley lines, the energy. There's a lot of stories about earth dragons. In Tolkien, they fly, they often shoot fire. We have St. George trying to kill the dragon. We have lots of earth dragon stories. But one of the interesting things is that they became barrow guardians, you know, the barrows that the ancient kings and noblemen were laid down in, were buried in. In ancient times, barrows and harvest hills, stone circles, and single standing stones were raised with a sense of reverence for the land, and with an awareness of its inherently spiritual power. When a barrow was filled with valuable grave goods to accompany the dead warrior or chieftain, it was highly probable that the early druids invoked spirit guardians to watch over the treasure, just as Egyptian priests invoked spirit beings to guard the treasures of the royal tombs and to terrify potential desecrators. In times, these guardians have become known as the monstrous dragons who so jealously guard their hoards at such barrows as the Dragon's Hoard in Oxfordshire, England, the Old Field Barrows in Strathshire, the Drakelow Barrows in Derbyshire and Worcestershire, and Drakehow Barrow in Yorkshire. There is even a long barrow that's supposed to contain the bones of a dragon killed and buried there in Walmsgate, which is a corruption of Wormsgate in Lincolnshire. So you see, the landscape itself takes on these stories about dragons. It's very interesting, isn't it, Lantern? Because look how earthy even the water dragon, you know, look how earthy the West has their dragons, whereas the in the East, they are celestial beings.
Right, right.
So that's That's a fascinating, you know, just to think about. Okay.
Well, I'm going to suggest a little tale that combines the fire of Prometheus and our friends, the dragons, and a Native American tale called The Legend of the Peace Pipe. We've all heard of peace pipes. And this is the story how the peace pipe was given to Native Americans. The Legend of the Peace Pipe from the Omaha tribe. The people came across a great water on logs tied together. They pitched their tents on the shore. Then they thought to make for themselves certain bounds within which they would live and the rules that should govern them. They cleared a space of grass and weeds so they could see each other's faces. They sat down, and there was no obstruction between them. And while they were holding a council, an owl hooted in the tree nearby. The leader said, "That bird is to take part in our council. He calls to us. He offers us his aid." Immediately afterward, they heard a woodpecker. He knocked against the tree. The leader said, "That bird calls to us. He offers us his aid. He will take part in our council." And the chief appointed a man as servant. He said, "Go into the woods and get an ash sapling." The servant came back with a sapling having a rough bark. "We do not want that," said the leader. "Go again and get a sapling with a smooth bark, bluish in color, at the joint where a branch comes." So the servant went out and came back with a sapling of the kind described. When the leader took up the sapling, an eagle came and soared above the council, which was sitting in the grass. He dropped a downy feather. It fell. It fell in the center of the cleared space. Now this was a white eagle. The chief said, "This is not what we want." So the great eagle passed on. Then the bald eagle came swooping down as though attacking its prey. It balanced itself on its wings directly over the cleared space. It uttered fierce cries and dropped one of its downy feathers, which stood on the ground as the other eagle's feather had done. The chief said, "This is not what we want." So the bald eagle passed on. Then came the spotted eagle, and soared over the council, and dropped its feathers as the others had done. The chief said, "This is not what we want," but the spotted eagle passed on. Then the imperial eagle, the eagle with the fantail, came and soared over the people. It dropped a downy feather, which stood upright in the center of the cleared space. The chief said, "This is what we want." So the feathers of this eagle were used in making peace pipes, together with the feathers of the owl and woodpecker and other things. These peace pipes were to be used in forming friendly relations with other tribes. And when the peace pipes were made, 7 other pipes were made for keeping peace within the tribe. One pipe was to prevent revenge. If one man should kill another, the chief took this pipe to the relatives and offered it to them. If the relatives of the dead men refused to accept it, it was offered again. It was offered 4 times. If it was refused 4 times, the chief said, "Well, you must take the consequences. We will do nothing, and you cannot now ask to see the pipes." He meant, if they took revenge and any trouble came to them, they could not ask for help or for mercy. Each band had its own pipe. Story of the Peace Pipe.
That is beautiful, beautiful, and beautifully told.
Thank you, my dear.
Beautiful.
You want to tell another dragon tale?
Okay. Boy, do we need some peace pipes in our country.
Well, I was thinking of Prometheus that you told earlier. And I was thinking of dragon fire, and I thought, this is a good mix. This brings the fire and Prometheus and the dragon of gift together.
Definitely. So, well, here's some stories about the fire dragon. And it's a story about King Arthur. King Arthur's father, Uther, at one time had a vision of a flaming dragon. This vision was so striking that he immediately asked his druids to explain its meaning to him. They told him that seeing such a blazing dragon meant that he should become king. So he took the name Pendragon, which means head of the dragon. The dragon thereby became the heraldic emblem and totemic beast of the greatest line of British kings, the Pendragons. This incident, which lies at the very beginning of the story of Arthur, provides us with the clues we need to understand fire dragons. Each of the four dragons of earth, water, air, and fire all have energy and power, but each mediates in a different way. Fire dragon, you see, is concerned with kingship, leadership, rulership, and mastery. And it's because of this that the druids were able to interpret Uther's vision so accurately. It said that his son Arthur, who wore a golden dragon on his helmet to symbolize his rank, and the fire dragon, has continued to be a symbol of authority and power ever since. There is also a dragon story about Merlin. Legend tells that the Welsh flag, which shows such a dragon, has evolved from the time when King Vortigern found that he was unable to build his fortress at Dinas Emery's because the stonework of the foundations kept collapsing. Merlin, when still a young boy and known as Emery's, was brought to the court, and he, with the aid of his mystical vision, explained that two dragons were fighting in a lake beneath the fortress, shaking its foundations. One dragon was a red, which represented the Britons, and the other was a white dragon representing the Saxons. King Vortigern ordered the ground to be dug to see whether Merlin was telling the truth. Both dragons were found, and a battle between them began. The red dragon finally won and became the emblem of Wales. So that is another fire story. Dragons, fire. Which dragons are your favorites?
I'm a fan of the Tibetan dragons.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, I can picture a dragon with the flames of Kali and just, you know, so much a dragon of multiple planes of existence that what looks like flames to us is really just the energy that just sizzles off the dragon.
Definitely. Most definitely. Well, all dragons, I think, you know, are doorways into other worlds. But the myths that grow up are always so interesting. So do you know a quick myth that you can tell us or a quick story about the Tibetan dragons?
No, but I can tell you a little something about thunder.
Okay. And I'll go get that.
Okay. This is called the Thunderbird, a legend of the Comanche. In the olden time, a hunter once shot at a large bird which was flying above him. It fell to the ground. It was so large he was afraid to go to it alone, so he went back to the camp for others. When they came back to the place where the bird had been shot, thunder was rolling through the ravine. Flashes of lightning showed the place where the bird lay. They came nearer. Then the lightning flashed so they could not see the bird. One flash killed a hunter. The other Indians fled back to the camp. They knew it was the Thunderbird. Once the Thunderbird in the days of the grandfathers came down to the ground and alighted there. You may know that is so because the grass remains burned off a large space, and the outline are those of a large bird with outspread wings. The Sioux, or Dakota, of whom the Assiniboines are a branch, pretend that thunder is an enormous bird,
and that the muffled sound of distant thunder is caused by a countless number of young birds. The great bird, they say, gives the first sound, and the young ones repeat it. This is the cause of the reverberations. The Sioux declare that the young thunders do all the mischief like boys who will not listen to good advice. But the old thunder, or big bird, is wise and excellent, and he never kills or injures anyone. This is an Omaha song to the thunder gods. Ye four, come hither and stand. Near shall ye stand, in four groups shall ye stand. Here shall ye stand, in this place stand. Turned by the winds goes the one I send yonder. Yonder he goes who is whirled by the winds. Goes where the four hills of life and the four hills are standing. There in the midst of the winds do I send him. In the midst of the wind standing there, the thunder rolls. A song from Omaha.
Beautiful. And when did you study? Did you study with any tribal elders in Omaha?
I had the great good fortune to live next door to a young man who was studying the mysteries. And he told me many stories. And when I was starting on the path, I was told that I have an Indian guide who is strong with me. And I just thought that today especially, when I was reminded when one of the political candidates spoke so strongly of Andrew Jackson and that he knew his enemies. And I also was reminded of the Trail of Tears, where so many were taken from their lands. And those stolen lands and Andrew Jackson's enemies brought tears to my heart. So I wanted to remember my brothers of the wind, my brothers of the thunder. Those hearts still fly. So I didn't want to go tonight without mentioning my brothers.
Good. Good. We need them. We need strong men. We need strong men.
And thank you so much, Pat.
And the sacrifices that we all have to make.
Yeah. Well, Kat, it's been a wonderful evening. I've enjoyed it so much.
Enjoy the weekend. Wild energy.
Well, I will bring the song to the drums.
Okay.
And the song of the birds.
Thank you all for listening to the Bard Show.
Thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll join us again next week. Thank you, Pat.
Thanks, Manson. Good night.
Marry me, and marry me again.
And marry me again.
Good night, the Bard's Grove. We'll see you next week.